The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, picture the scene. It's a quiet afternoon at the Jack Wilson Studios, and suddenly an email falls into the inbox. It's from a previous guest, asking if we might be interested in his latest topic, a book he's written about a philosophical filmmaker named Alejandro Jodorowsky. I'm interested in anything that interests this guest, and I'm interested in philosophy and in filmmaking, so of course, I agree, but the name bothers me. Jodorowsky, that is not someone I'm familiar with. But why does that name sound so familiar? And then it hits me. I am familiar with him, and his story is one of the wildest stories I've encountered. Jodorowsky, as explained by William Eggington, today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. We will get straight to it. I'll tell you about Jodorowsky and how I knew about him, and then we'll have Bill Eggington explain why Jodorowsky's films are interesting to him from a philosophical perspective. And then we'll cap things off with a My Last Book from, let's see, how about David Sterling Brown? That was another sweet response. This little question really brings out interesting answers each and every time. So one more bit of business before we get to the philosopher / filmmaker. We have an email from listener Rowan, who writes, "Hello, Jack. I'm a new listener by way of my husband, who discovered your podcast last year after we had a conversation that went like this. Me, after you finish a book, do you ever look up author interviews or book discussions? I just finished Kazuo Ishiguro's Clara and the Sun. Husband, a more voracious reader than myself. And a few days later, he excitedly shares your podcast with me. Anyway, we really enjoy the podcast. I have a strange request. Said husband will be recovering from a surgery in April that will leave him bedridden for a few weeks. He has decided to use his recovery period to read Ulysses. I was wondering if you could send him a voice note of encouragement / enthusiasm / guidance for this endeavor. He would get a real kick out of it. Thanks for considering." Well, Rowan, thank you for the kind words. I love hearing about couples who listen to the show, and I love the reminder that a lot of people are still discovering podcasts in general and this podcast in particular. And we have a lot of James Joyce in our archives. Maybe your husband, who his name is Chris, Rowan and I had a subsequent exchange where we talked about getting the message out to Chris. We have a lot of James Joyce episodes in our archives that might whet Chris's appetite. Probably the most popular episodes on Joyce that I think we've done have been the two or three I did one Christmas season, where I talked about my love for the story, The Dead, the last story in the Dubliners collection, and probably my favorite short story of all time, that at least that wasn't written by Anton Chekhov. But that might be a bit wintry for this time of year. And anyway, Ulysses is a whole other project, isn't it? So let me think. Well, first of all, Ulysses is a fantastic way to spend some time. What a great idea. And here's my advice for Ulysses. I think I've read it three times, maybe four. Once in college, where I sprinted through to make sure that I had read it all, that my eyes had passed over every single word, even if my mind hadn't fully absorbed the meaning or the significance or the context of what I was reading. Because I was reading it for a class, and I worried that there might be something on the exam. So that was one way to read it. Then I read it again while traveling in Tibet when a fellow traveler and I swapped books because we had run out. I then read Ulysses, and he tackled Proust. So, looking back on it, kind of weird that we found each other, but there we were doing our trade. Then I read it once more, at least much more slowly and carefully, with a book of commentary by my side when I was in graduate school. And I think there was another time since then, but definitely it was before my kids were born. I haven't tackled it since those two have been around. So it's been at least about 20 years. But here's my advice, for what it's worth. Think of it as if you're reading a book in translation in a language you know pretty well, but not perfectly. You can read it fast if you want, and you might need to read it fast in parts to really get a sense of the rhythm and the momentum of the book, the flow. This is what I do with Dante. I can read Italian, but not perfectly. A lot escapes me, especially Dante's 14th century Italian. But I'll read a page or two straight through to get all the sound that I can and the rhythm and the pace. And then I'll go back and read the same passage with the commentary right next to me, having the translation side by side. And I'll go back and forth between the Italian and the translation to make sure that I understand everything. Or I'll skip the translation and I'll read and look up words myself and read the passage as if I were the one doing the translating, line by line, word by word. Really slow down and savor it that way. I've never read the whole Commedia that way, though. That might be too excruciating. Although maybe there will come a time when that's what I want from that book. The point is, I give myself some leeway. I don't set goals and say that I have to finish the whole book in X number of days or anything like that. I also don't set restrictions in the other direction and say, well, I have to read line by line, word by word. I can't move on until I understand every single reference. I do a mix of both. And I would recommend the same with Ulysses. Yes, you will be climbing a mountain, but don't forget that you are not the mountain. You are a mountaineer. This is about your experience, not the book's. That sounds crazy that we even have to say that. But sometimes we have so much reverence for a great book. We act like we owe the book something, like we have to live up to the book's expectations. Well, we don't. It's not even like a mountain in that sense, where at the very least we do owe the mountain something. We shouldn't litter or burn down the trees or something. The book is your mountain to climb. It's all yours. And the climbing experience will be completely up to the climber. So if you're feeling like a quick jog for a few minutes, then do that. If you're feeling like stopping and absorbing the view and breathing in the air, then do that. You might spend a whole morning in one spot, and that might be the best part of the whole read. That's the beauty of the mountain. It will accommodate you. It will be there when you ascend and again as you descend and when you pause for breath and when you eat or sleep or just stop to look around in wonder. Maybe you're the kind of mountaineer who will spend a whole morning gazing at a rock or a flower. Maybe you're the kind who wants to sprint straight up as fast as you can and come back down even faster. Either way, you'll have that mountain experience, and there's no one right way to do it. The only wrong thing you can do is to feel like you should have done something differently. You can take something from each and every experience, and if you read it fast and wish you'd have taken more time, well, that's fine. There's always a future read where you can try a different approach. So, Chris, best of luck with the surgery and the convalescence. Enjoy Ulysses. And when you hit the phrase, the ineluctable modality of the visible, smile and think of your old friend Jack, who once spent his morning gazing at that particular flower. Thank you for listening to the show. And thanks to you, Ron, for helping Chris to find the History of Literature podcast and for your kind and generous words. Okay, on to Jodorowsky. So I don't think I've ever seen a film by Jodorowsky, but I saw a film about him. I went through a stretch where I was flying to Los Angeles for work at least once a week, DC to LA, and sometimes twice. I probably made something like 50 or 60 flights in a period of a year or two. I'm vague about it, about the number and about the time period, because I was vague. I was permanently vague. My mind was gone vague. It's not easy to put your body through that kind of a schedule. It turns out the time change, the time change back, plus all the work I was doing, plus I had my family at home, and my body broke down. At one point, I was coaching my son's basketball team, and we had a game, and I was lying in bed, and I literally could not move. I couldn't lift my limbs. I called to my wife and asked her to text another dad to take over as the coach. I felt like I'd been run over by a truck. A pancake. I don't know if it was physical or mental or what, probably both, but I just shut down. This was a crazy schedule. Once I flew into LA, and then I had a long drive, and I arrived at my hotel, and it was about 10 o'clock. So I thought, okay, good. I've got a full day ahead of me tomorrow, but it's only 10 o'clock. I'll go to bed now, get a solid 8 hours, wake up early, power myself through the day with the help of some coffee. So I went to sleep, and I woke up, and I was wide awake. And I thought, uh-oh, it's still dark out. Clearly, it's kind of early. Must be only 4 or 5. But if I get up, so I didn't get my 8 hours. But if I get up now, I can hit the coffee and sustain myself through the day with that. At least I got 6, maybe 7 hours of sleep. That should be enough to get me through this long day. And so I get out of bed. I look at the clock and it's 11:30 p.m. I'm wide awake. Wide awake. I've slept an hour. 90 minutes. Now, what do? I can try to power through the whole next day, through the whole, I could start drinking coffee now, keep drinking, go almost 20 some hours on an hour and a half of sleep, or I can stay up for several hours with no coffee and then crash and then have to set the alarm, probably fall asleep about 5 and have to wake up at 6 with an hour of sleep and disrupt my deep sleep to get up and then go for the coffee at that point. It was not good. No good options. Those were rough days. I was ordering 3 triple espressos and pouring them into one cup like an alcoholic who hides in the closet secretly drinking. I didn't want the staff at Starbucks to know that all 9 shots were for me. This was a very unhealthy lifestyle, but I was just powering through. All this is background. In the middle of all this, I was on these flights from DC to LA and back again in this sort of fugue state. I can never sleep on planes more than a few minutes. So I watched a lot of movies. Virgin Airlines had a good selection. And there was one that was so wild, I wondered if it was a mockumentary. It did not seem like everything in this movie could have happened to one person. That movie was called Jodorowsky's Dune. And in my fugue state, I just watched the movie twice back to back and I couldn't get over it. This guy, Jodorowsky, who's in the movie, had been trying to make a movie based on the Dune novels back in the 1970s. And he built this team around him that included graphic artists like Moebius and a set designer or an artist, H.R. Giger, and he signed up Salvador Dali to be in it and Orson Welles to be in it and Mick Jagger and others. These people were all going to be in his movie, and Pink Floyd was doing the music and his son was going to star in it, and he put his son through this crazy training regime in order to play the lead. And through all of this, Jodorowsky appears in this film. The interviews he gives, he appears as this kind of art. He's an artistic figure, but he's almost something other than human. He's got so much energy and so much light that pours out of him and so much playfulness and charisma. He's like a woodland sprite or some kind of spirit who has an insatiable drive to get this movie made, and not just to make a great movie, but to change the consciousness on the planet. This movie, this documentary, is still available on Max if you have access to Max, or you can probably rent it somewhere. The documentary I'm talking about now, the Dune itself, the movie he was planning to make, never got made. But they had it all drafted out with 3,000 storyboards. The movie was going to be somewhere between the 2 hours that the studios wanted it to be and 10 or 14 hours, which is what Jodorowsky thought would be more appropriate. And so this book of storyboards, this giant book with, it shows all the costumes and sets and special effects and everything else all planned, all the shots in the film, it went around to all the Hollywood studios and nobody knew what to do with the project as a film. But everyone wanted to see the book because as a vision, an artistic vision, it was really ambitious and not like anything that anyone in Hollywood had ever seen before. And then, they show this in the documentary, the ideas in the book, that book of Dune, as orchestrated by this magical puppeteer of others, of artists and costume designers and everybody else, Jodorowsky, the ideas in that book made their way into Star Wars and Alien and Terminator and all these other films. The people, the team who worked on Dune with Jodorowsky went on to work on all these films in the 70s and 80s and beyond. Their vision is our vision. That's how we see space and science and that kind of film. This is kind of a source for it, a wellspring of it. So the movie Dune did have this kind of impact or life, even though it was the great disappointment of Jodorowsky's career. So Bill Eggington's book on Jodorowsky is about more than just Dune. Before Dune, Jodorowsky was a successful avant-garde filmmaker who was a favorite of John Lennon's, among others. And he's also made films after Dune. His movies are not always easily understood or even easily categorized. Jodorowsky was born in Chile. His parents were Jewish Ukrainian, and he did not have a very happy childhood. His father was abusive to his mother, and I've never heard of an origin story quite like his. In fact, I think I'm going to skip over this because it is difficult to listen to. Let's just say that his mother had reason to hate her husband and to resent Alejandro. And she told him at one point, "I cannot love you." That was his mother. And he also had an older sister who, according to Alejandro, was trying to get him kicked out of the family. Jodorowsky didn't like the fellow villagers much either. They treated him poorly because he was from an immigrant family. So what did he do? He read. He retreated to books. Poetry and philosophy and psychology. He started publishing poetry himself at age 16. And by his early 20s, he had started to build a career in the theater. He was an expert in mime, among other talents. And he worked as a circus clown. And then he moved to Paris. While in Paris, he met Marcel Marceau, the famous mime, and he went on tour with him. And finally, in 1957, when he was 28 years old, he made a film based on a novella by Thomas Mann. It was called The Severed Heads. It was an auspicious beginning for what was to come. Throughout the 60s, Jodorowsky was working on surrealist works and working with surrealist artists, and he made a handful of feature films. And then in the 70s, he made a pair of films, the first an acid western called El Topo, and the second, another surrealist film called The Holy Mountain. And now we're getting into the area that Bill Eggington is going to help us understand. So I won't talk too much about those movies, but what were they about? What ideas were they advancing? Sometimes we might think that surrealism, I don't know if you've spent much time with surrealism, we might think a couple of things about it. One is that these works have no philosophy underpinning them. They're just there for shock value, and the point is they might try to make us rethink what we think of reality. Or we might think that they have a little more to them than that. But the lesson of it is something we've absorbed by now. That is the idea that our subconscious is trickier than our conscious state. And if we dip into that subconscious, we'll find a reality that's dreamier and less logical. You've probably seen surrealist paintings and maybe films, and they are interesting, but sometimes they're only interesting in one way. You take the same thing from them. Ah, yes. More illogical, dreamlike scenes. This artist has tapped into his subconscious and is representing what he or she found there. And it's different from what we're used to seeing represented, which more typically represents the conscious state. And it does kind of open you up. Your level of interest might be the same as it is when you hear about someone else's dreams, sometimes fascinating and sometimes a little less so. Well, Hodorovsky is up to something deeper, I think. And it takes a philosopher or a philosophically trained scholar like Bill Eggington to help us understand what that is. Luckily for us, he's a very good explainer. Bill Eggington on the works of Alejandro Jodorowsky after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Okay, joining me once again is William Eggington, who was here before to discuss his books, What Would Cervantes Do?, co-written with his colleague David Castillo, and The Rigor of Angels, Borges, Heisenberg, Kant, and the Ultimate Nature of Reality. He's here today to discuss his new book, Alejandro Jodorowsky, Filmmaker and Philosopher. William Eggington, welcome to the History of Literature.
It's wonderful to be back, Jack. It's so great to talk to you, as always.
So let's jump in with a filmmaker who might not be familiar to a lot of people. Who is Alejandro Jodorowsky?
Alejandro Jodorowsky is really a fascinating character, artist, filmmaker, more than a filmmaker. And of course, I'm making the case in this book that he's an important philosopher as well, a philosopher and the filmmaker together. But he's also a world-renowned guru, a self-help expert, a puppeteer early in his career. He's known in France as being the co-author of many great what are called bandes dessinées. So the French have this culture of comic books, we can call them, but of course they're have a certain seriousness in the French culture. He's well regarded in all of these different areas and fields. And among those many is a really small but extremely influential body of films. And when I was approached by the series editor for the Bloomsburg Philosophical Filmmaker Series, Kostitsa Bratatan, he asked me which filmmaker would I like to write a book about, if I could, from a perspective of making an argument that they have a coherent and important philosophical project. And I immediately said, well, if no one has volunteered to write about Jodorowsky, I would love to do that. Mm. And so Jodorowsky is originally from Chile and now lives in France. He's, I think, 94 right now, as of this writing. The back of my book says 90, but that's the problem of copy taking time by the time it comes out. But he is prolific and still going strong at 94. And so it's been a pleasure engaging with his work over the last couple of years and writing this new book.
Well, some people might know him as I do, which is from a documentary that was made called Jodorowsky's Dune. And he appears in that. He gives interviews and he is such an appealing figure. He's so charming and so eager. He's such a creative spirit. And I kind of something that might be lost on people when you talk about his background, because it's so avant-garde and so eclectic, that there's somebody in that documentary who makes the same point, who says, you know, he watched Jodorowsky's films and thought that he was going to be encountering a madman, and that the person who would, because Jodorowsky acts in some of these films and he does go kind of out there, but he thought that the guy walking in the room was going to be kind of this whirling dervish, Tasmanian devil type, I think. And instead, the guy who walked in looked very, you know, he was very well dressed. He had a sort of European refinement or sophistication. And you know, he was very handsome. And he does seem to be one of those people who maybe on the outside appears to be quite normal and normal, using that loaded term, but then, you know, when you see his art, you see that his mind is going places that other people's minds don't go.
Boy, you said it. His mind certainly does go places where other people's minds don't go. And you're absolutely right. He is extremely charming, extremely well-spoken. To give him credit, I don't think he could have pulled off the kind of films that he was doing throughout his career if he didn't have a certain ability to talk people into doing things.
Right.
He clearly has that in spades, but let's not sell him short either. He really is in some ways, a madman. There's a method to his madness for sure, but he's definitely out there in all sorts of ways. His entire career and his life has been anti-establishment in so many ways, right? And his early embrace of surrealism, to give a little anecdote, when he left Chile and went to France, he didn't speak French at the time. He speaks French beautifully now, but with a very strong Latin American accent. He went there with the express purpose of reviving, of bringing life again to the surrealist movement. And he met the great godfather, André Breton, of surrealism towards the end of the latter's life. And of course had the chutzpah to tell him, my name is Jodorowsky. I've come from Chile to revive the great tradition of surrealism, which didn't go over really well with Breton.
Right.
But he truly is a character in so many ways. And, as you see in that great documentary that you referenced, you know, ambition is also something that he had tremendous amounts of, self-confidence and ambition. It's a wonderful story. I think, the documentary is billed as the story of the greatest film never made.
Mm, yeah.
And it's really beautifully done, because it makes a very strong case for how, in failing to actually make the film, and we can go over a little bit, because I think it is an important story to tell, of Frank Herbert's Dune, and then ultimately it was first made, as we know, by David Lynch, and then later and more recently by Denis Villeneuve, that while he failed to do it, the artistic vision that he presented was so overwhelmingly powerful that it ended up spreading throughout the cinematic universe and leaving its traces everywhere in a kind of beautiful reenactment of what actually happens with the character Paul as he's subsumed into the universe at the end of Frank Herbert's Dune. And I thought that was really lovely and fitting for what Jodorowsky had attempted to do with this extraordinary project that he got underway, he got funding for. He had talents from Mick Jagger to Pink Floyd.
Yeah. Salvador Dali.
Salvador Dali was signed on to act and was being his usual histrionic pain in the ass self.
Orson Welles was going to.
Orson Welles, yeah. Absolutely. So it was a great big juggernaut that was on its way. But then the uncompromising genius that is Jodorowsky, who really, like I said, he also is a real force in French comic books, created a comic book version of what the film would be, right? As he mapped it out.
Right. Like a big storyboard with also character sketches and paintings. And he had the help of really genius illustrators like H.R. Giger and Moebius. And they put together this huge book that was in every studio in Hollywood. And this is kind of a way for us to get back to his earlier films, I think, because on the hand, his success with those films was what allowed him to take on this project of Dune. But at the same time, it had given some producers some anxiety about, well, is he going to be able to pull this off? Is it going to be a big boondoggle? They were impressed by this book and how specific it was and how built out it was. But at the same time, they wondered, is this somebody who, you know, based on his earlier films, is he going to be able to do this type of film?
Well, I think it was not only anxiety, it was justifiable anxiety, because the point that I was getting to is that his uncompromising vision was such that it would have ended up being something like a 16-hour film, and he wasn't willing to cut it. And so he was going to these studios, major motion picture studios, with this extraordinary book, which nowadays there's only a few copies left in the world. And I think the last time I heard, they're each valued at about $3 million.
Wow.
But that he would say, no, this is the vision. I have it all set. You have to fund a 16-hour film. And they were like, yeah, sorry, buddy. We're not going to do that. No, but sorry, you wanted to continue your question.
Well, no, you took me into a good place, because one of the things I'm trying to get at and make sure that we convey is his motivation. And so it wasn't just that he thought he was making a great film and that it needed to be 16 hours instead of, you know, cutting 30 minutes to bring it in at under 2 hours or something like that. But he was trying to accomplish something with that film.
Yeah.
And what was he trying to accomplish? And was that something that ran throughout his filmmaking, or was it something that he had developed for Dune in particular?
It absolutely is running throughout. And while I don't spend a lot of time talking about Dune, since he didn't actually make the film in the book, what he's trying to do and what that documentary beautifully conveys is so aligned with what I believe he does extremely well in the six films that I really do end up writing quite a lot about. And those six films, as I said, it's a small oeuvre, but it's an important one, and it represents an extremely coherent vision. And it's a vision that coheres with his overall practice. I called him a guru before, and I don't mean it in any kind of a depreciative way. I mean, he really is someone who, I think, from what I understand, has helped a lot of people in the world. But he developed a kind of practice, a health practice, that he calls psychomagic. And it's influenced by tarot readings and by shamanistic healing to a certain extent, although he refuses the comparison himself, by different forms of psychoanalysis. And that's in part, as you know, what my book is arguing, is that he refuses this, and I would claim on the basis of the lack of familiarity with a certain kind of psychoanalysis that I then try to make the case that he comes really quite close to in his approach, with important differences that can get into when we get into that. But the idea of this overarching coherent vision is that human beings are creatures who are imbued by culture, language, and meaning, and that we suffer from our relationships with meaning, that meaning can make us hurt, and that when we suffer from meaning, from language, from our interpretations of the world, often what can help is a kind of intervention that is itself cultural and artistic. In other words, it shares with psychoanalysis a kind of cure. It's not a talking cure in the sense that psychoanalysis is. It's not about sitting with your back to an analyst and speaking to him or her while the analyst occasionally intervenes. But it is about meaning, about art, and about practices that Hodorowsky, for his patients, for his clients, will actually put into play. He'll stage, he'll write small performances that are intended to break through the kind of blockages, the psychic blockages and repetition compulsions that we develop in our lives. And the overarching coherent vision is that art itself has a power to heal and has a power to change. And I think he really was. He refers over and over again, to go back to your question about Dune, to his attraction to making this. And he also says, look, he didn't read Frank Herbert's Dune, but he knew what it was about. And he said, I get it already. I want to make this film. But what he was going to make was really going to be Hodorowsky's Dune, as the title of that. Right. It was going to be his vision. And it was a uniquely vast artistic vision that was intended to be not just a film, but and not just even a work of art, but as he said, an entire movement. He wanted in some ways to save the world with this film.
Yeah.
And he saw the figure of this messianic figure of Paul in Frank Herbert's Dune as a vehicle for the kind of interventions that he was ultimately creating in his work and interventions that he was enacting with his clients, but on a kind of global scale. I would make, he says, a film that would be seen by everyone and it would have this impact on them. And they would turn around and carry this message with them. So he wanted to change the world with this film. And that, I think, is why he refused to compromise it to the desires of the Hollywood studios.
Right. So when we think of psychoanalysis, we often think of a patient who is suffering in some particular way and trying to help that person. But like you were saying, he had a kind of planetary vision or a view that all of humanity could use this kind of boost to their consciousness expansion or what exactly was it? But he, in other words, it would apply to all of us. It wouldn't just apply to the person who is unhappy or having trouble sleeping or something like that. But it would be, it's something we're all blocked in a certain way. And he viewed it as a way. And I don't know if he believed that he had overcome this or if he was also struggling to overcome it, but he seemed to believe that it was almost like a gift he could give to humanity.
He does believe that he has this gift. And, you know, and as I said, many of his millions of followers believe it too. And many have testified openly that they've been cured of whatever it was that ailed them. As I call them repetition compulsions. And as you know, that's a very psychoanalytic way of referring to it. But when we get trapped into certain behaviors, and those behaviors we do over and over again, even though we know that they're not good for us or good for others, they could be addictive behaviors. They could be ways that we enter into relationships. We make these choices. We think that we're acting with, full free will. And then here we go again. There we've gone and entered into a relationship that's making us miserable. Or, you know, I have this fear and I can't get over this fear. He has documented, pretty well documented, I have to say, his interventions in all sorts of different ailments, from stuttering to a fear of getting pregnant on the part of a woman who at the same point really wants children, all sorts of things that precisely the kind of interventions that psychoanalysts might get into. And his theater pieces these individualized theater pieces that he creates and then goes into these enactments with teams of actors and with his patients, his clients, you know, from by and large, at least from their testimonies, have often had really remarkable successes. And as you say, it's that kind of a general global ailment that I think he would associate with consumerism, with a general unhappiness of culture and inability to get outside of one's skin and think of other people, that he was trying to break through, or he had this ambition, this global ambition of breaking through, of shattering and rebuilding by making a film that would be more than a film. And that was the ambition behind Hodorowsky's Dune.
Okay, let's take a quick break and then come back with more from William Eggington. Okay, we're back. So I guess my big question is, does he believe that his films will show this process happening and persuade people that this is necessary and essential and something that can be done? Or does he believe that his films will do it, that by watching his films, you will have this kind of experience that will help you down this path?
You know, honestly, Jack, I don't believe he necessarily or explicitly believes either of those things.
Oh, okay.
The six films that he wrote and created are individual artistic expressions. The most recent two are very personal in the sense that he's telling the story of his own life, but doing so in this very unique Khodorkovsky surrealist induced style. And the earlier ones are works of fiction, at the very beginning, in particular with Fando and Lis and El Topo and Sacred Mountain, La Montaña Sagrada. Those films are not only, I mean, it's even hard to call them fictional. They're true surrealist objects of engagement. I think he was pursuing, again, an artistic vision. My reading, however, is that they align very closely with what he explicitly then works out in his treatises on and explanations of his psychomagical practice. So in other words, I have found this coherence, and I would argue that this coherence is there. And I imagine that he would probably accept that interpretation of his work as well. I think he would appreciate that and probably does, you know, is quite aware of it as well.
Right.
However, I'm not aware of him having gone out and said, you know, watch these other films of mine, they will cure you, as he sort of explicitly was saying about this hope for what he would do with Dune, which he never made. But I do, as you know, go through in the book and sort of make an argument about how there's an implicit theory of art and what art can do. And that I do think he would accept and agree with. And insofar as he is an artist who makes art, that he would hope that his artistic productions are having that kind of effect on audiences.
He clearly does believe that an artist and the kind of personal vision of an artist and just the whole, I'm going to call it, I guess, spirit or soul of the individual who's working as an artist will matter, and that the art will reflect it. He talks in that documentary about having people who he, you know, very famous people who were maybe even willing to work on Dune. And he would say, no, I didn't get the right feeling from that person. He's not one of the spiritual warriors that I need to be working on this film.
And he did say that. Yeah. I remember that, to back you up with an example, I think it was when he first went to their London studio to talk with the members of Pink Floyd.
Yes.
And remember, they're high off having released Dark Side of the Moon.
Dark Side of the Moon. Yeah. You'd think they'd be right, perfect.
Fifth year anniversary of Dark Side of the Moon, one of the greatest albums ever made. And he said they were sitting in there eating hamburgers. And this turned him off. And he's like, I'm not going to talk to you. And he walked out on Pink Floyd. They later reconciled, and Pink Floyd were indeed, all the members were kind of entranced by him and did agree to make the film with him. But you're absolutely right. At first, he did not identify them as spiritual warriors of his skin, and he walked out on them.
And the people that he would get, they would, you know, they moved to Paris and they would sell all of their belongings in order to work on the film. And it really was like you could tell that he was enlisting them in his project, in his vision for it, and in his just his whole approach to it. And so it does seem to me that he would probably accept your reading and saying, well, here is a figure who has all of these beliefs and other writings, and his films would naturally reflect that. If he's a true artist who's dipping into himself in order to bring a vision onto the screen, it's not impossible to believe. It almost seems likely that the film would reflect his core beliefs.
I do believe that for all the reasons you just said. And also you see analogies or alignments between some of the characters. I'm going to mention one in particular that he sometimes portrays in his films. As I just mentioned, the last two films that he made are explicitly autobiographical. So he appears in the films and has his own children playing himself. But in Sacred Mountain, the structure of the film, which involves a group of as they're referred to, industrialists, kind of masters of the universe in various different areas, who essentially leave their industries behind and follow the alchemist, this character played by Hodorowsky himself. This really ends up being what you were just describing as the documentary Hodorowsky's Dune kind of describes, that people who would just sort of pick up and leave what they were doing because they were so entranced and beguiled by his vision and come to work with him in Paris. And this is exactly, you know, what you see in Sacred Mountain. You see these different people in almost a disciple-like way, as the 12 disciples did with Christ, leaving their families behind, leaving their industries behind, leaving their wealth behind, and following the alchemist on a path of self-discovery and enlightenment. So I do think, you know, this is his third film. It's after the resounding success of El Topo and the fact that El Topo, which showed at the Elgin Theater in Chelsea and kicked off the midnight movie movement of the 1970s. Then it was seen by John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and they spread the word. And the Beatles' former manager, or I guess maybe he was still Alan Klein, was the manager at the time, but he got interested and he helped work out the funding for Hodorowsky's next film, and that became Sacred Mountain, which at the time had really, especially for an art film, had quite a budget, and he really made to use that term again, a juggernaut of a film that still hits the popular artistic imaginary today.
Yeah, so let's talk about El Topo and just maybe you could just describe what it's about and why it was so unconventional, but also then touched such a nerve.
It really did touch a nerve. And, you know, I would make the argument that El Topo, so first of all, what is El Topo? It was referred to in one of the, you know, I think it was in the pages of the New Yorker in a review after it had made this big splash in 1970 as an acid Western. Mm-hmm. And a wonderful combination of words to describe it. It is the story of a gunslinger out in the desert, and he goes on a spiritual journey, and the gunslinger is, he encounters a woman. The woman convinces him that he should, on this spiritual journey, face four unbeatable, invincible gunslingers, each in their own way. And these gunslingers aren't, that's where it's sort of the matchup with the Western template that it's based on stops, because these gunslingers are all very strange characters. There's a kind of Hindu style yogi character who's got so much control over his body that he can actually open up holes and let bullets pass through and they don't touch him. Or there's another who just plays his flute in an enclave filled with white bunny rabbits. And there's another who's an ancient man who's given up his gun and can catch bullets with a butterfly net. So these are these characters that one by one, El Topo, spurred on by his lover, goes to encounter and to fight with and ultimately to defeat. Now, the interesting thing that I, you know, in my reading of it is that this is really a story, as I say, about a patient who kind of tries out and kills four psychoanalysts before going on to another to another level of enlightenment, because then the second half of the film, he becomes a kind of monk character. And we can get into that as we go forward. But this film had extraordinary success, and I don't necessarily think that the success that it had, that sort of countercultural major influence in the early 1970s, that I don't think it had a lot to do with the philosophical content that I'm pulling out. I would be a little bit more cynical about it and say that combination of being an acid Western, as the New Yorker article said about it, was really, it hit the drug culture at just the right time, right? It was featured as the first of the Elgin's midnight movies. There was no question that, you know, people were lining up around the block to get in there, and they were watching the movie high and just kind of tripping out on all of the cool wacko imagery that was going on in that. And I think, you know, Hodorowsky definitely built on that and that success, which was, like I'm arguing, a little bit of a luck that he happened to fall at the time that he did, to say, yes, but my vision is important and I'm going to continue, you know, I'm going to use this and run with it, essentially. And that's when he was able, you know, the next couple of years to put all of his work into creating what in some ways is a much more coherent philosophical and surrealist vision in Sacred Mountain.
When you say that the character is seeking to destroy four psychoanalysts, is that
do they represent sort of four different approaches to psychoanalysis, or four different flawed avatars of psychoanalysis? Or how do we tie that back into our understanding of psychoanalysis? And, you know, it sounds like a great story. Right. And so,
I mean, pushing it a little bit by calling them analysts, in the sense that what he's really doing is he's trying to find himself. And in trying to find himself, he's seeking these models. But his only model is aggression at the beginning of the film. And in each of those gunslingers, in his own way, is trying to be an analyst, in the sense of trying to say, look, I'm not here to defeat you. I can defeat you, each of them kind of claims, but really analyze, you know, ask yourself the question, why are you trying to enter into this aggressive battle with me? And that's why I call them analysts. They're responding to him with a question, and he's trying them out. But when I say, normally what you would say is someone goes trying out their analyst and they refuse them, they resist them, right? So if an analyst is pushing you to the point where you're refusing, you're resisting, that means that, you know, they're kind of getting to you in a way. And one of the common responses is, well, you fire your analyst. You go and you keep looking for another one.
Yeah, yeah.
You try a different one until it sort of hits you that, you know, wait a minute, maybe I'm the problem. Maybe it's not the analyst who's the problem, and that this is a very common phenomenon, right? So yeah. My little quip there is that he's, you know, kind of literalizing that. He's firing in the sense of he's actually killing each of these and going on until he gets to the point where he realizes that it's the aggression itself that's the problem. And then he goes through a kind of conversion. It's a hallucinogenic, he consumes with an old lady in a cave some kind of a mushroom, and then is reborn in the second half of the film. And first he has this crazy kind of platinum bleached afro at first, and then he shaves that off and he becomes kind of a Buddhist monk-like figure who leads an exodus of disabled people who've been essentially captured and put into a mining system near a Western-style town. And he leads them on an exodus. He tries to become their savior and lead them out through a kind of nonviolent resistance, which ultimately fails. They all get massacred. And then in a sort of eruption of violence himself, he massacres the entire town and then immolates himself. Mm. And so my argument there is that this is, you know, the early films, that and the prior film, Fondo and Lise, are about failed attempts to get to some kind of a self-enlightenment. And it's only really with Sacred Mountain that he breaks through. And it's because this figure, the alchemist, finally figures out what Hodorowsky will later refer to as psychomagic, that there is a process of the kind of symbolic self-destruction that needs to take place in order to release the pent-up aggressivity that's baked into the ego in the form of our defense mechanisms.
Now, I don't know if this is swerving us into something new or if this ties in, but you talk about the connection with Lacanian psychoanalysis, and I wasn't sure what you meant by that. Can you explain what Lacanian psychoanalysis is and how it relates to these movies?
Definitely. And so one of the arguments that I make, you know, at the beginning of a little documentary that that Hodorowsky did about his own work, his own psychomagical work, he does resist the comparison with psychoanalysis. And he specifically talks about Freud, and he makes all the differences, you know, and he says, you know, Freud absolutely said psychoanalysts shouldn't touch their patients. Psychomagic practitioners like myself, we're constantly touching our patients. It's all about this connection. Psychoanalysis cures with words. We cure with theater and art. And, you know, point well taken. These are different approaches. But I say in this book that if you take a more recent version, in fact, a version of psychoanalysis that grew up in France in the 20th century, the psychoanalysis that was taught by and ultimately practiced by Jacques Lacan, a psychoanalyst whose life spanned most of the 20th century, and who really represents the kind of analysis that's practiced almost exclusively in France, almost exclusively in Latin America, the two areas where psychoanalysis really has made the largest impact, one sees a lot more parallels to the kind of work that psychomagic and psychomagical practice on the part of Hodorowsky does. There are some important differences. While Lacanian psychoanalysis, it does come to an end, famously in Freud's case, an analysis could be interminable. You just keep on going. there is a distinct end. Psychoanalysts, or I should say patients, come to an end of analysis when, in some sense, they become like an analyst themselves. They adopt what Lacan calls the discourse of the analyst. It doesn't mean that they hang up a shingle at that point and start practicing. If you do want to hang up a shingle and start practicing, you have to go through the exact same analysis that anyone else would. But in the end, structurally, you've done something similar to your psyche in both of these cases. And so a lot of your listeners, or at least some of your listeners, may know the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who is a very prolific political philosopher. He is someone who has gone through this process. He is, an advocate of the philosophical approach of Jacques Lacan. When I was younger and a university student, eventually graduate student, I actually studied Lacanian psychoanalysis with Slavoj Žižek. I invited him on multiple occasions to the various graduate programs where I was, and ultimately even when I was a professor did that as well. So I'm also influenced by that school of thought. And hence, when I was interacting over the years with Khodorkovsky's, with his thought, with his writings, with his films, over and over again, I would see that the kind of approach that he exemplified in his work reminded me of certain ways that Lacanian analysis works, certain ways that Lacanian interpretations deal with art, deal with the world, deal with politics. And that's really, you know, the seed for this book.
Right. Now, as a director, I mean, when we talk about an acid film and expanding consciousness and so on, you know, I'm thinking of kind of montages of color wheels and the music and the speed of the images flashing by and so on. Does he use techniques like that as part of it, or is he doing this with the narratives that we've been describing so far?
That's a great question. It's actually both. The narratives are very strong. And despite being dyed-in-the-wool surrealist, which means that narrative coherence is often the first thing to go, you do have to piece together often plots in Khodorkovsky, there is a strong narrative flow in his films. That said, he's very, you're in this world and weird things happen and visual effects happen a lot. Sacred Mountain is filled with psychedelic-style visual effects. And, you know, they're not always explicable. That's in rational terms. That's kind of the point of surrealism. Surrealism is constantly asking you a question. Why is this happening? Right. And it engages. I think I would argue in part of what it's doing is it's the analog to the analyst's silence when you're trying to come up with a coherent story about yourself and your desires and your trajectory in life. And the analyst isn't answering, and you're just continuing up against that silence to tell stories about yourself. Your interpretive desire as someone watching a film of Khodorkovsky's is to make sense of the senseless in some ways. And that structure is pulling you in. It's a kind of medium that's very cold in the sense that Marshall McLuhan said there are hot media that overwhelm you with meaning, and there's cold media that pulls you in and makes you engage and makes you make sense of the world. In that sense, a surrealist film, it's throwing all sorts of things at you, but not tying the knots together. You've got to do that. And in that way, a lot of the answers that you come up with, at least that's what theory would, are answers about yourself.
Well, I am tempted to ask you a bunch of questions about Žižek, because I'm sure that was a fascinating period of your life. But you mentioned a couple of others that I wanted to ask you about, philosophical influences, Kant and Hegel.
Here's the thing. Kant and Hegel were huge philosophical influences of Lacan. Lacan is known as the sort of structuralist and then ultimately post-structuralist version of Freud. He sort of brings language, which is already implicit and to a certain extent quite explicit in Freud. He makes it even more explicit how language, as he says, is the way he would put it, the unconscious itself is structured like a language. But behind all of this very technical psychoanalytic work and renovation of psychoanalysis that Lacan did is really a philosopher's mind and someone who had dealt very deeply with the history of philosophy. Hegel was extremely important in that regard. Jacques Lacan in the 1930s went and listened to Alexander Kojève's lectures on Hegel that did many of his contemporaries, and he was so obsessed, apparently the anecdote is that when he heard of Kojève's death, he quickly jumped into a cab and ran over to his apartment to try to be the first to lay claim to his annotated version of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. Mm-hmm. So the influences on Hodorowski, I would say, are in some ways, they're tangential, not necessarily direct. Hodorowski is a great reader. He went to France, became part of the intellectual scene there, did read a lot of philosophers, and the philosophers that he read and interacted with were influenced by this longer philosophical tradition. But for me, Lacanian analysis, without having himself been influenced by thinkers like Kant and Hegel, wouldn't be what it had actually ended up being.
Mm. And when you were putting together this book, to what extent were you able to draw upon interviews and his writings, his nonfiction writings, to understand Hodorowski? Did you find his explanatory essays or anything like that where he's discussing his works from a critical point of view? Were you resisting his own interpretations or seeing that you were expanding on those or in contradicting them in some sense? Or were you just going back to the films and writing straight from that? Or what approach did you take?
Well, honestly, a little bit of everything of the above.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, there are a lot of such interviews, and he's, you know, his heart is out on his sleeve. He writes autobiography. Yeah. He has made two autobiographical films. He is purportedly in the process of making a third. Those are, by the way, extremely beautiful films, beautifully made. Dance of Reality and Endless Poetry. I absolutely adored them. And his autobiography, which is called the written autobiography, Dance of Reality, includes extraordinary amounts of very valuable information for someone like me writing about him. At the same time, I do maintain some authorial liberty and the prerogative to disagree with El Maestro when from time to time. So I don't always agree with his own interpretation of his work. And to cite the example that I already mentioned, he's really drawing a much brighter line between himself and there's almost some kind of defensiveness when he talks about Freud and psychoanalysis. And I resisted that just because I think, as I said, I think he's not as familiar with certain psychoanalytic, post-Freudian psychoanalytic approaches. And I think there's a lot more potential overlap there. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as I would agree, I mean, one thing, if his cures do work the way that he, you know, offered evidence that they do, they're much faster than psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is, you know, really a long process of breaking down resistances that kind of with the explosive, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but violence of his performances, I guess the claim would be that he manages to break down those resistances much, much more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Do you, when we talk about films like this and when we analyze films like this, sometimes it makes it seem like we've found a body of work that is very intellectually stimulating and helps to clarify ideas we have or helps to make us think about things like the history of philosophy in a new way and that kind of thing. But do you also find these to be moving? What's your, which doesn't have to be the case. I like films that do both, but I'm wondering, are people going to watch these films and will they feel like I really could use a guide to help me understand kind of the ideas behind this, or can they find them absorbing and moving?
Let me give you a kind of nuanced historical answer by actually quickly going through all six films that I write extensively about. The short answer is, I think the first three are more of the second kind of film that you're talking about, that viewers will probably say, wow, this is really interesting visually. I'd sure as heck need a guide to kind of understand, or at least someone to suggest, you know, like Eggington's book, what the meaning is behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a period of where he stops making films, or he makes a few that really we don't consider to be his films because they were someone else's screenplay, or he did attempted to make a high-end film that then, you know, that was a studio film that then the studio was displeased with his version. And then in the 1980s, he gets back to making his own films again, and he makes three more into the current time. Those latter three are very emotional films and very moving, all three of them in different ways. Strangely enough, the fourth of the films, so the beginning of that second phase, is a hallucinogenic slasher pick that's, as I say, it's sort of like, if El Topo was an acid Western, this is kind of like a surrealist kind of acid-induced remaking of Psycho, of Hitchcock, and yet deeply, deeply moving in many ways. Beautifully acted, beautifully with a deep storyline, with touching characters. So that's, I think many people, this is called Santa Sangre. Many people have seen many of his films, are most attracted to Santa Sangre just because it's just such a beautiful film, despite, you know, what I just described it as being a stepchild of Hitchcock's Psycho. Mm. And then his recent films, his explicitly biographical films, Dance of Reality and Endless Poetry, are very moving and extremely beautiful. They're poetic. They're works of poetry.
Have you had any contact with Jodorowsky?
I have not. He has a huge presence on the platform formerly known as Twitter. Mm. And I have a minuscule, tiny presence that I got onto the platform years and years ago when someone said, "Oh, Bill, you write books. You need to be on Twitter." So I said, "Okay, I'll do that." But I clearly never did it well enough to get any kind of a following. But I have messaged him on just a couple of occasions just to try to get his attention. I messaged him in Spanish on Twitter and now on X. And I've never heard back from him. He sends out, I think, a weekly message, and it's usually a kind of an inspirational one. I think it's every Sunday, if I remember correctly, he sends out a message, but it's really to his many millions of followers, and it's, you know, in line with his self-help, his kind of guru work.
Right. Well,
yeah.
I'm wondering, since obviously you don't have his reaction to the book, what you think that reaction might be if he were to get a copy of it and read through it.
I would hope that he'd bless my vision at least partially, right? That he would say, yeah, I agree with, you know, Eggington that my films, my artworks have this kind of structural correlation to what I'm doing in my psycho magic. And I agree that in the way that he's describing that I'm trying to help people and I'm trying to cure this kind of suffering that he calls repetition compulsions. And I disagree, probably, he would say, with the proximity he tries to draw between myself and psychoanalysis. But I would hope that he would agree more than disagree, is my guess.
I'll be a little more ambitious for you and suggest that maybe he would read it and say, "William Eggington, this is one of my spiritual warriors."
I hope you're right.
Okay. Well, the book is called Alejandro Jodorowsky, Filmmaker and Philosopher. William Eggington, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Jack, it's always a pleasure. So good to talk to you again.
There we go. A little space jazz for you. Okay. Finally today, we check in with David Sterling Brown. After we discussed Shakespeare's White Others, I asked David this special question. Okay. I'm joined now by Dr. David Sterling Brown, an expert in Shakespeare, among many other topics, and the author of the book, Shakespeare's White Others. Professor Brown, this question comes from a listener who asks, "What do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written."
Okay. I love this question. It's a really hard one. I don't know. I've been in the mind of family lately. And so if I could get a book written, so it doesn't exist and it will never exist, but if it could get a book written by my late grandfather that I could read, and probably have it be somewhat of an autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
I would love that. Mm. Like, yeah, that would be a great last book to read.
Yeah. Who was your grandfather? What did he do?
Oh, so my grandfather's name was Forrest Lee Joe Hollis. And he was born and raised in the South, and he then moved up to Connecticut, and he worked for like a sort of company that did stuff with like tools, snow plows, that kind of stuff. And so I remember every winter they'd break out these Let It Snow stickers. And yeah, that's what he did. He was a blue collar man.
Mm-hmm. And did he have a particular perspective or something that makes you want to know kind of what was going on in his mind and his story of his life?
Yes. Everything for him was he liked things to be easy. And I don't mean it like they couldn't be difficult, but he was a sort of no drama type of person.
Yeah.
And he just loved, his favorite thing to do was just sit outside in his yard and water his garden or look at the grass. And I feel like our society has gotten so far away from that with the advent of technology and all of that stuff.
Yeah, right.
I would love to learn the ways.
Yeah, right. He's like, was it Cincinnatus who left the empire and took up the plow and just lived on the farm and got away from kind of the hustle and bustle.
Yeah. And, you know, he actually died with a literal smile on his face. He actually had cardiac arrest, but he had a smile on his face when he found him. And I was just like, how great is it that just ending encapsulates kind of who he was as a person?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, when we talked in the main interview about Shakespeare's White Others, you were telling me that Titus Andronicus was one of your favorite Shakespeare plays. I kind of wondered if you might choose that, but I think this is a better choice.
I think so too. I don't know if I want to end my life with reading about Tamara's children being baked into a pie.
Okay. David Sterling Brown, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you.
Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of the History of Literature. My thanks to David Sterling Brown for that wonderful response, and to Bill Eggington, who always makes this show seem smarter than it really is. Poor show. Makes me smarter, I guess I should say. You can check out his book at bookstores everywhere, and do check out that documentary, Jodorowsky's Dune. It is highly recommended. And our thanks to listener Rowan, and good luck to you and your husband, Chris. Next week, we have episode 600, and we'll be going back to one of our old faves for that, and we'll have an old fave in episode 601, too, so do please join us for those. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.